I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. What is the greatest human achievement? Well, maybe you never ask wide-open questions like this because they don't generally lead to any real conclusion. But I think questions like this might be important and probably not just rhetorical. So what is the greatest human achievement? I know you've been wondering about this for years. Well, you can always Google it, and Google it I did just to see if there's a ballpark sort of answer or some kind of emerging consensus. Getting to the moon, yeah, Apollo missions, that's a thing. The development of vaccines gets a mention, the list of great achievements that pop up. Well, it includes things like the various declarations of human rights, the Mona Lisa by Leonardo, the plays of Shakespeare, running the 4-minute mile, climbing Mount Everest, the great pyramids of Egypt. Well, it really is great sport to muse over these things and then try to add more and more contenders to the list. I think it all comes down to the criteria that you choose to apply to the pool of possible answers. Greatest in what way? Technological advancement? The moral improvement of our species, the creation of beauty, the preservation of the planet and all of its diverse forms of life. So I'm tempted to back away from this question altogether as just a big quagmire that you probably don't want to go into without knowing exactly why you're going there in the first place. Well, on our show right now, we are going to go there, but we're going to narrow the field of possible answers by applying a single and very important criterion. What is the greatest human achievement in terms of reducing human tragedy? And I think we have a very good answer at hand. Let me introduce you to our guest, and I think things are going to clear up really quickly. Perry Klass is with us. Dr. Klass is a professor of journalism and pediatrics at New York University and co-director of New York University's program in Florence, Italy. And that's where she is today as we speak with her. Perry Klass attended Harvard Medical School, completed her residency in pediatrics at Children's Hospital in Boston, and we're going to be talking about her new book, A Good Time to Be Born, How Science and Public Health Gave Children a Future. It's an account of how victories over infant and child mortality have changed our world. Dr. Klass, a pleasure to visit with you.
I'm so glad to be here.
I just have to start with the obvious because we're in the middle of a very interesting global situation. The year 2020 gets some bad press these days. And, you know, if you talk to any recently graduated kids from the class of 2020 and talk to them about their job prospects, and if you showed them the title of your book, A Good Time to Be Born, they might have a beef there. They might say, well, that title's a little 2019-ish, you know?
Well, what I was trying to say in the title, and of course I was writing the book before we were in a pandemic, but I stand by it, is that the children who are lucky enough to be born toward the second half of the 20th century and into the 21st are being born at a remarkable moment in human history because they're being born at a time when they can pretty confidently expect to live to grow up, and their parents can expect them to live to grow up. And that becomes true gradually in the middle of the 20th century, over the course of the 20th century, not everywhere in the world, but increasingly around the world as infant and child mortality are beaten back. And so even though I don't mean to say that we don't face difficulties, and I certainly acknowledge that we're learning all over again in the hardest way possible the power of the invisible universe of bacteria and viruses that live around us and take advantage of many different things in our habits, even so, I don't think that many parents would trade for the situation of a parent in the 19th century or the 18th century or even the early 20th century, when if your child had a sore throat, you had to think to yourself, could this be diphtheria? Could this be scarlet fever?
You know, I was just chatting with my wife last night, and my wife did have scarlet fever as a child. And as we were talking about it, she said, my mother tells me that when she received the diagnosis that she wept, that she just broke into tears. And that's even just, you know, we're only talking a few decades back because there's so many memories, at least for that generation, of what scarlet fever meant.
That's absolutely true. And I was thinking about that when I went to see the new movie of Little Women with my daughter. And you look at, you know, child, a healthy, thriving child, almost dying of scarlet fever. I had that exact same experience as a pediatrician that your wife describes, in which I proudly told a grandmother that I had made the diagnosis of scarlet fever. To me, it was, you know, I'm so smart. I looked at the rash. I figured out what it is. Now I'm going to give you some penicillin and make it all better. And the child's grandmother, who was from a different country and remembered this as a disease that sometimes killed babies, began to cry. And I think we're not that far. One of the things I'm talking about in the book, my grandmother was having her children in the early 20th century in New York City, and it was still then, in the early 20th century, really very common to have children not make it out of the delivery room, not make it to their first birthdays, not make it to their fifth birthdays.
Now, paint a picture for us, if you would. If you are a parent living any time in this stretch of from the early days, let's go back to, as you say, 18th century, 19th century, early 20th century. You're a parent. What are the numerical prospects of survival for your infant, for your child?
So when we talk about infant mortality nowadays, what we mean is out of every 1,000 live births, how many children don't make it to their first birthdays? And so now in the United States, and these are not the best numbers in the developed world or among wealthy countries, but that's at about six out of every 1,000 who don't make it to their first birthdays. And the great majority of those are babies who die in the first month of life. And I think we know that there are tremendous disparities in this country. The infant mortality is much higher among African Americans and other minority groups. But overall, we're talking now about 6 out of 1,000. At the beginning of the 20th century, when my grandmother was having her children, for infant mortality, that is to say for babies who don't make it to the first birthday, it was certainly more than 1 out of 10. It was probably between 1 out of 10 and 2 out of 10 who don't make it to their first birthdays. And then after that, probably at least another 1 out of 10 to 2 out of 10 who don't make it to age 5 because of all those other diseases that we were talking about, scarlet fever, diphtheria, polio, all the diseases which come later on as children are growing. Now, if you go further back in history, they would have thought that 1 in 10 was pretty good. There are estimates that if you go back a couple of centuries, you may be talking actually about 30%, 40% of all children not living to grow up. In the colonial times in America, which it was, life was not always easy, there are estimates that would say that as many as 40% of the children born didn't make it.
As you're giving these numbers and discussing this, it occurs to me that what our expectations are of the medical professionals, just the whole experience of childbearing, what has become normative, this is in the broad sweep of history, we're thinking about normal experience very differently.
Absolutely. And that was one of the reasons I wanted to write the book, was because there's this whole lost world in which this touches pretty much every family. And I want to make that point strongly. No matter how rich you are, no matter how powerful you are, you can't keep your children safe. And when you go looking for these stories, and when you go looking for these graves, some of them are going to be royal. Some of them are going to be the richest people in history. Some of them are going to be the presidents of the United States. And the sense that wealth and power and that the best medical advice that you can have can't actually keep your children safe, up until very recently, that was true. One of the examples I would give you is that the Rockefeller Institute, the Rockefeller University, it's founded by the first billionaire, the richest man in history, John D. Rockefeller. He founds it when his beloved grandson dies of scarlet fever. And again, it's not because the medical attention wasn't there.
You point to a very specific person in history, and maybe this is a pivotal moment in history. Maybe he was observing the change, the shift, or maybe he helped precipitate it. A fellow named George Newman, 1906, a British physician, and you say he published something titled Infant Mortality, a Social Problem. Is it around that time period where people maybe start hoping that science can prevail in to some degree here?
Well, at the beginning of the 20th century, and Newman is very much an important figure in this, people do a couple of things. They start counting those statistics that I was giving you out of every 1,000 live births. That means registering and counting all the births and also registering and counting all the deaths. If a baby doesn't make it out of the delivery room, if a baby doesn't live long enough to be baptized, are you still taking note somewhere in your official statistics that that baby existed? And not only are people counting, but people in many different countries for the first time begin to think about this as kind of an index to how your country is doing, which is still the way we think about it. How are you doing with your frailest, most vulnerable new potential citizens? And if you're France, how are you doing vis-a-vis England or vis-a-vis Germany? Or if you're one part of the United States, how are you doing vis-a-vis another part? And now, there's a lot that goes into this. Some of this might be that you're thinking ahead to the possibility of future workers. Some might be that you're thinking ahead to the possibility of future soldiers, and you're looking at those other countries and wondering whether you're actually, you've got enough children growing up. And some, I hope, a lot of it, I hope, is a feeling that it's the, one of the ways you look at how your country's doing. Can you take care of the vulnerable? Can you support families? Can you make sure that children survive? But when Newman publishes that book and he's been counting, he says he's bemoaning the number of children who die in the United Kingdom every year. He says we're losing a regiment of small beings. But one of the things he's saying is still in 1906 is he knows that children are vulnerable. He knows that a lot of newborns are born too weak to survive. He knows there's a lot that you can't do. But if you take care of families, if you make sure that there's clean water, that there's basic good living conditions and nutrition, that the children who are not too weak from the very beginning, you can help them. And that's why he calls it a social problem. It's not just an issue of what's going on in each individual house. It's an issue of decisions that you're making in your community, in your city, in your state, in your nation.
Well, I'm hoping you can give us now some sort of a survey of all of the various approaches, the actions that were taken, the problems that were being addressed, because there are so many of them. You know, we live in an age when people just want a silver bullet for something. They want a one-size-fits-all. Can we find the one vaccine that will be the cure-all? And you have a hard task to tell a story of so many different battlefronts.
Well, I wanted to tell a story that I'm not sure has been quite told and appreciated as a story, because you're absolutely right. It's not a single story. The story of vanquishing polio or vanquishing diphtheria, sort of setting a problem, solving it, developing a vaccine, getting the vaccine out there, defeating one disease. That's a more straightforward story, and they're great stories. But what you're looking at here is a combination. You're looking at a combination of public health efforts that let's clean things up, let's build sanitation systems, let's think about how to get safe milk, pasteurized milk, to even to poor families, a whole lot of public health efforts. Then you're thinking about some really amazing science, the origins of bacteriology, figuring out where these diseases come from, that they're not just caused by bad smells or by, you know, whatever particular theory you have, that you can actually not only you can identify the bacteria, you can identify the viruses and learn how they work, and then the the brilliance of figuring out the vaccines and figuring out the antibiotics, but along with the public health and along with the science and along with the medicine, there's also, I think, this incredibly inspiring story of parent advocacy, parents figuring out that there are things they can do to keep their children safe, which goes all the way from hygiene and clean milk up into the 20th century when you look at things like car safety and safe sleep, and you get these terrible diseases that have killed so many children out of the way, and you look to say, what is still putting children in danger? Where are the children now at most at risk, and how can we make the world safer for them? And I think there you start to hear a lot of parent voices. You start to think about, because you've started to believe in this possibility that you can actually make the world much, much safer for children, and that if you can, you should. That it's something we collectively owe, not just to our own children. It's not just make my house safe. It's make our community safe, make our country safe, make our world safer.
I suppose there was a long season of fatalism before that.
I think that even if you reached back to my grandmother, you'd probably have found a certain amount of fatalism. And one of the things I talk about in the book is I think that that may have helped in what would otherwise have been a tremendously anxious position. I think she knew the world was terribly dangerous, and I think on some level she had to accept that. It was a dangerous place. There were things she could do, but there was a limit to what she could do. And I wonder if some of the anxiety that parents, even though by many standards parents are lucky today, but they feel the weight of that burden that if you make the right decisions, the world should be a much safer place than my grandmother probably believed it ever could be.
We're visiting with Dr. Perry Klass about her book, A Good Time to Be Born, How Science and Public Health Gave Children a Future. Time for a short break on Constant Wonder. And when we come back, I want to talk with her a little bit about smallpox. Not because it's a story from the deep past and it's a problem that's been solved, but because maybe variolation and the smallpox story, maybe the issues of solving that problem still have some kind of pertinence even today. I suspect they do. That's why I'm teasing you with this. Stay tuned to Constant Wonder. Thanks for listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. Dr. Perry Klass with us, a professor of journalism and pediatrics at New York University, and she's author of A Good Time to Be Born, How Science and Public Health Gave Children a Future. Dr. Klass, sometimes we hear about smallpox, and it's in textbooks from the time I was in high school, and we think, well, that's something way in the past. But just recently in the news, I saw the word variolation again. And I heard it in conjunction with a discussion of masks and COVID-19. And this theory that's out and about, and people are pursuing this, and I know I'm not asking you about this because I'm not necessarily drawing on your expertise in this. I just saw it in the news. But that word variolation is the idea is that maybe masks mitigate the viral load. And if you look into that, you say, well, then maybe the cases are less severe. Or maybe it buys time for an immune response. This does tie into the history of many, many decades ago of solving smallpox.
It certainly does. So variola is the name for the smallpox virus. So variolation, before there was any kind of vaccine, the idea behind variolation was that you deliberately gave somebody a small dose of smallpox, actually some of the matter that you had taken out of the pox of an infected person, and you injected them not with a vaccine, which would be something which is not the actual live virus, but that you actually injected people with live smallpox virus drawn from a sick person, variola, variolation, with the hope that they would get a mild case of smallpox and then be immune. And the problem with it, this is something that was practiced in many different parts of the world. It was practiced in classical China, it was practiced in Africa, and was actually brought to America by enslaved people who were able to demonstrate the practice. It was picked up by Cotton Mather in Boston. It was brought to England by Lady Mary Wortley Montagu, who found it being practiced in Istanbul. The problem with it is that when it didn't work, the person got a bad case of smallpox and often died. So it was an incredibly dangerous procedure. And the reason people took it up was that smallpox was so devastating. And smallpox, especially in children, smallpox was a disease that killed 1 in 3 of the people who got it. So for everyone, the odds were terrible. But with babies and small children, the death rates go up well above 1 out of 2. They go up toward 70 or 80%. So if you were scared of death rates like that, maybe you were willing to try variolation, to try having somebody inject the real disease. What vaccination is, and the brilliance of vaccination, again, the word comes from a virus's name. Vaccinia virus is the cowpox virus. And so vaccination comes from the observation that dairy maids who got cowpox, a much milder disease, were also immune to smallpox. So vaccination is this brilliant way in which you trick the immune system, you turn it on without having to expose it to that incredibly dangerous virus that you use in variolation. Instead, you use this much more benign cowpox virus, vaccinia, vaccination, that fierce immune system is still turned on, you're still immune, but you don't get either a mild or a severe case of real smallpox.
And you know, it's quite obvious today, a lot of us are having a crash course in immunology, and that is being mediated through so many different sources, some trustworthy, some not trustworthy. And it's been kind of a moving target for many of us who follow the news. I wonder, though, if there isn't a way for health education to proceed forward where we can better understand the present in light of the past. And I think that's where your book comes in to be so important.
Well, I hope so, because, I mean, as someone who was writing a book with some sad stories in it, since it's about both about that lost world of infant and child mortality, but what I love about this story, I mean, if you ask me, even though this is not a single story, it's not a simple story, it's not a simple crusade, I think when you put all of those pieces together, it might be our greatest human achievement. We took ourselves from a species which all through history had to accept that a large number of children didn't survive and that there was a grief which touched almost every family, some families many times. We've put all of these different kinds of activism and achievement in science and public health and sanitation together into changing our most essential biology, our most essential situation. I mean, when I talk to you about vaccination, I sort of feel we should be proud. This is a real piece of cleverness to understand our immune systems and turn them on in this way. I think it should give us faith both in the ability of science and medicine to find answers, including answers to the situation we're in, but also in our ability, A, to figure things out, even very complicated things, B, to find answers, and C, to spread those answers around so that it's not just about keep me safe, it's about keep everybody safe.
I want to mention the name Sarah Josephine Baker, and I'm hoping you can tell us a little bit about her. And the reason I want you to do that is then my next follow-up question will be, who do you see as the Sarah Josephine Bakers working today?
Oh, well, she's one of the people who I write about a lot. She was a doctor who trained at the end of the 19th century and worked at the beginning of the 20th century, that same period we were just talking about, when people are becoming aware of infant mortality, thinking about public health practices that you could bring to bear. And she's a great character. She writes an autobiography in 1939, looking back on her career. And her voice is just so lively and interesting and practical, and she connects to the individual families. She's worked as a public health doctor in New York and knocked on doors and seen babies die. And then she writes about the idea, for example, that when the summertime comes, a lot of babies get sick, milk spoils, families don't have refrigerators, babies get diarrhea, and babies die. And she writes about the realization that if she sends smart public health nurses into homes and families learn how to keep the milk clean and how to prepare formula, or you encourage breastfeeding, that you can stop babies from dying. And she writes about a startling idea. The way to keep people from dying from disease, it struck me suddenly, was to keep them from falling ill. And she talks about applying these public health ideas. She's involved in sending nurses into the schools to reach families where they are. She's working in New York at the time that there are a lot of people living in terrible conditions in the tenements, new immigrants, people crowded together. It's a perfect setting for infectious diseases. But she's writing about the advantage of sending nurses into the home, working with parents so they understand how they can keep their children safe, using the schools, all of these very, very essential public health innovations, which are actually happening before there are antibiotics, before there are vaccines other than the smallpox vaccine. And I love her voice. I love how connected she is to the reality of what those families are living through, but also to the sense of how you get these innovations out there, how you work with the political system. She's the first director of the Bureau of Child Hygiene in New York City, which is the first such bureau in this country. We're going to have an office which is concerned with keeping the children healthy. And when you ask me who are the people today, I mean, this is a moment when we're seeing all kinds of extraordinary activity by healthcare workers and other essential workers who keep the healthcare system running so that they can take care of people at a really difficult moment. This is, I mean, I have pediatric colleagues who are finding ways to get immunizations to children now when there are families in some areas who are nervous about bringing their children into the medical system, finding ways to reassure parents that the medical system can be a safe place, finding ways to get vaccines out to children, because we still, as pediatricians, in some ways, one of the things we keep worrying about is what if, for reasons like the pandemic, we end up with children who are vulnerable to other infections. None of us want to see measles. We've seen too much measles in recent years. None of us want to see the bacterial diseases, meningitis. None of us want to see any of the diseases which we've stopped seeing happen because the parents are scared to bring their children in.
I kind of hear you saying that a Sarah Josephine Baker type today is the kind of person who takes the knowledge and the wisdom of medicine and the clinics and the hospitals and is able to help spring that information and those practices loose and carry them, transport them out into the communities, into the schools, the homes, maybe other venues, I don't know, churches, but to be on the front lines in sort of exporting that knowledge.
That's a very, very good way of putting it. I wish I'd said that. I think that, you know, especially in pediatrics, I feel this, but I think it's true in other forms, other branches of medicine as well. So much of this is about meeting people where they are and figuring out what's worrying them and finding ways to bring the science and the medicine to bear on the questions that people are asking you. So much of it's about listening, so much of it's about trying to figure out how you can solve the problems that people bring to you rather than only coming at them with your own agenda. And I, you know, this is something we learn over and over again in medicine is, you know, ask questions, ask open-ended questions, listen hard, and then try to bring what you've studied and what you know to bear.
So if we were to look at a graph of infant mortality over the decades and centuries, and if there was just high, high percentages, really shocking rates from our perspective, going back 200, 300 years ago, And then if we look the other direction to the future on this graph, and we're looking at some vanishing point approaching zero where we really want to save children, if we could, all of them, it's a very lofty goal. What would the next steps be? What would the next battles be that we would confront?
Well, the most important thing we could do would be to take probably to take very good care of mothers, both during pregnancy and before pregnancy. And that would be one of the first things we could do to address some of those disparities that I talked about earlier in both infant mortality and maternal mortality, would be to provide very good, high-quality preventive care during pregnancy and before pregnancy so that people go into it with the best possible odds for their own health. And the reason I say that is if you look at what we're, the reasons we're still losing children, a great many of those losses have to do with prematurity or other issues that come up around childbirth and pregnancy. So the more you can lower the odds of prematurity, the more you can lower the odds of problems that come up during pregnancy that can sometimes threaten the mother, sometimes threaten the baby, sometimes both, the more you're going to be getting at the sources of the infant mortality that we still see. And then on the other side of that, we would want to look at how we can keep children safe, and we'd want to look at the different kinds of accidents and safety. We'd want to think about safety guns and gun violence. We'd want to think about making addressing issues like cars and car accidents. We'd want to think about drowning. There's a list of things that we should be thinking about if we want to keep children safe. And one of the things I would say about that is that we should understand that we can see some of these dangers because we, in fact, are not losing so many children to all of these diseases. As pediatricians, we're not spending our lives trying to take care of children with diphtheria and children with scarlet fever and children with measles complications. So we can look and we can see both the accidents and the dangers that still exist, and also the questions that parents bring to us about how children develop and how children learn and how children grow and how we can not only keep them safe but try to help them grow up to be all that they can be.
Dr. Perry Klass, it's a pleasure to have a chance to visit with you. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Perry Klass, a professor of journalism and pediatrics at New York University. She attended Harvard Medical School, her residency in pediatrics at Children's Hospital Boston, and her book is titled A Good Time to Be Born, How Science and Public Health Gave Children a Future. A short break now, and then we're going to talk about another story of overcoming a devastating situation for children. Sometimes a baby's blood type is more than just a curiosity. There's a serious history of a blood problem that used to pit a pregnant mother's immune system against her own baby. That problem now solved, and millions of babies, millions of lives saved. Stay tuned for that tale, coming up next on Constant Wonder. This is Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. We've been talking about the sharp decline in child mortality over the course of a century, and really we've moved from a tragic world where most families could expect to lose more than one child to a world where most families in the developed world at least face very little risk, if any, in this department. We're going to zoom in now on one of these specific victories. This win took place over a blood problem that would lead the mother's body to attack the unborn child as if it were a foreign invader, to reject the baby. It's called rhesus disease, Rh disease. And to learn more about this, I spoke with Julian Guthrie. Guthrie is author of Good Blood, A Doctor, A Donor, and the Incredible Breakthrough That Saved Millions of Babies.
So many people today have the privilege of not knowing that this disease even exists. It's a blood-based disease, again, called Rh. And the reason why people don't have to think about it anymore is because of this breakthrough that I write about. So what Rh is it happens when when the mother and the father are Rh incompatible, where the mother is Rh negative, the father is Rh positive, and the baby inherits the positive blood type from his or her father. And the mother, so the mother's antibodies, which are made, of course, by the immune system to fight things that it doesn't want in the body, perceives her own baby as this kind of foreign invader, if you will, and sends her antibodies, of course, this is unwittingly, to destroy the baby's red blood cells. And that causes anemia and miscarriages and repeat miscarriages, like the lady that you referenced who, you know, was so heroic in wanting to help others and prevent what she had suffered. But it for, you know, for decades, no one knew how to stop it. And thousands of babies were affected every year. And so it's really a story of this blood-based disease, and it was quite prevalent, and it was this medical mystery that researchers on several continents were trying to solve, just as blood research really became very exciting around the 1950s. Rh was discovered later, and so if you have positive or negative, you know, on your blood type, it's because whether you are Rh negative or Rh positive, something that a lot of people don't know.
Oh, so that plus and minus, that's specific to the Rh business.
It is, exactly. It's whether you have the Rh protein or you don't. So everybody has the Rh factor, you know, whether it's positive or negative.
So in New York City, where you left us, you've got Dr. John Gorman, you've got Dr. Vince Frieda. They have this idea about using passive antibodies in some fashion to inject them. It's kind of a smoke and mirrors thing where you kind of trick the woman's body into thinking, well, I've already made these things. I don't need to make any more. And then maybe, I'm guessing, the level of the antibodies is low enough that the harm is not inflicted on the fetus.
Exactly.
So if that's what's happening in New York, way across the other side of the world, you've got this James Harrison fellow. Introduce him to us.
Oh, my gosh. I love James Harrison as a character. He's a remarkable human being. What I love about him is like I always gravitate to stories of the extraordinary in the ordinary. And James Harrison is an Aussie who was a sickly child and needed, when he was a teenager, to have a major surgery to save his life. He had developed bronchitis and it had turned into pneumonia. And he, during the surgery, which was quite perilous, it was in 1951, he had to have multiple, I think 13 units of blood transfused into him. And at the time, blood was actually brought in bottles of blood rather than the plastic bags. And it was a very risky surgery, and it lasted for around 11 hours. And it was a turning point in James's life in ways that no one would know until decades later, really. So James, when he woke up in the hospital that day, his father told him he had been saved by the blood of strangers. And James, even though he was this very mischievous, fun, you know, kind of raucous boy who was always wanting to be out in the street, you know, playing cricket and all, but he said to his father, he said, I will repay the favor. And he began donating blood at age 18, the legal age in Australia to begin donating. And he never, ever, even to this day, till recent times, could watch the needle going into his arm. But he made a commitment, and he believed in the power of donating blood to save lives for medical research. He began donating every few months. He would go on to donate for 60 years, over six decades. And for the last decade plus, he was donating blood every week. And he donated blood in all 1,173 times. He was in the Guinness Book of World Records for the most consistent blood donor. But his blood was found to have these antibodies in spade that were needed for this this breakthrough in RH. Researchers and directors of the blood bank in Australia began to look in their files, in their records of donors, and they began to look for who had particular blood type and showed particular antibodies in their blood. And up comes, of course, James Harrison. James's blood was changed at a molecular level when he had that perilous surgery at age 14 in Australia. And your body remembers it, you know, it has an incredible memory, and the antibodies had pretty much gone dormant. They would show up in the blood tests, but he was called into the office to the director of the blood bank in Sydney, and he was told, "You have special blood. We want to use it. We want to enroll you in this program that we believe will save babies' lives in Australia." And again, in Australia, it was affecting one out of every six babies. So this was a big deal. So that's how James, who had been a consistent donor, you know, even donating, taking time off from work. He was an accountant for the railway, taking time, very humble guy, who liked to say, you know, "I don't have money. I don't have power. I do have blood. All I need to do is sit back, you know, roll up my sleeve and extend my arm." And he said, "That's something that I can give, that everyone can give." So James became a part of this RH program in Australia, and he was such a superlative donor, both in his consistency, you know, coming in as often as he could, sometimes, you know, and for years, every single week while he worked full time, always making time for that. And the antibodies that he had been activated in that blood transfusion so many decades earlier were put to work to save lives. And the impact of his 1,173 incredibly consequential acts of generosity resulted in him saving 2.4 million babies in Australia. And this is a, you know, this is a story of his heart, his commitment, you know, how we all can make a difference in the world. And I think that's a message that especially resonates today.
This is just phenomenal to think that he and he alone could accomplish so much. And yet there must have been others who had good blood to share too. And maybe he, I don't know, at some point word gets out that they need more donors.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. And that's where you have the first donors who were really, you know, the workhorses of this program in Canada and in Australia in particular. We'll zero in on Australia, were women, again, who had suffered losses and who had suffered miscarriages, you know, one miscarriage after the other, you know, had lost eight babies, had lost nine babies, had lost 10 babies. And they were asked, you know, despite their grief, to come in and would you be a part of this program to prevent the grief and the heartache that you have suffered? Help us help other women not go through that. And so the workhorses, in addition to James Harrison, were these women who had suffered and didn't want other women to, and families, women and men, families, to suffer in that same way. So it kind of brings tears to my eyes to think about the goodness of their hearts and the generosity of their spirit when they themselves had endured such grief.
There are a couple of other facets I just must fold in here, which are just kind of curious to me. I don't know why. They just strike me as curious. One is that back in New York area, Gorman and Frieda, the two doctors, they recruit help from convicts at the Sing Sing prison to help pursue. That's kind of an improbable arc to the story, too, you know. And then also, I guess, one of the doctors had some relative, a near relative, that kind of became a human guinea pig for this, too.
You know, these are things that I love it that you bring those things up, because this could never happen today. There were so many kind of, you know, unexpected and eye-opening plot twists here where, yes, Vince Frieda and John Gorman, you know, they needed volunteers, quote unquote, volunteers for their trials. And so at the time, it was okay to enlist inmates as volunteers, and they were very careful to make sure that they were volunteers and that there was no quid pro quo within the prison system. But they had these remarkable men within the prison at Sing Sing, which was a really notorious prison, you know, in upstate New York, who stepped forward and became volunteers in their very first trials. That really showed that this was working. And, you know, at the time this was happening, there were no tests for hepatitis. There were no, you know, this was not without risk. So there was some risk involved, as well as to, you know, as to James Harrison in Australia, because we didn't have the safeguards in place, you know, in terms of donating injections that we do have today. As far as the guinea pig, this is a great story, and again, could never happen today. So when John Gorman and Vince Frieda had done their trials at Sing Sing, they were still in the process, actually, of doing these trials. They didn't have approval for this treatment, but John Gorman found out through his father, who was a doctor, that his own brother and his sister-in-law, they were expecting, and they were Rh incompatible. And so John Gorman's father in Australia, who kept track of, you know, of his son's work in New York, you know, said to him, you need to get this treatment, this experimental treatment, which John and Vince were very confident about, but didn't have the numbers, didn't have the regulatory approval. You have to get it to Kath. That was his sister-in-law. That was John's sister-in-law. And she was in London. She and Frank, who was also a doctor, were in England. And John and Vince, there's a great scene in the book where, you know, John and Vince are in the car and they're driving out, and they've got this little vial, you know, in this like almost Tupperware container. I think it had like green spots on it or something, on dry ice. And they were bringing it to JFK Airport, and it would, you know, to be shipped to Heathrow. And again, it was, you know, it was human, it was labeled human serum. And it was not approved. It was, you know, unknown, but Gorman was confident that this would work. Obviously, this was something he was so confident about that he was willing to send it to, you know, his own flesh and blood, his sister-in-law and his brother. So it's a daring story of, you know, getting it to England. Kath, you know, she goes into labor on their way to the airport. Then they get to the hospital, and then the doctors at the hospital in Liverpool, you know, were like, they'd already talked with Gorman and the team, but there were other doctors, you know, on call. And so the question came up, what is this weird experimental vial? We're supposed to inject it into her? What? So you can imagine the questions and the drama that came up. But it proved, you know, it Kath, she got the injection after she gave birth to her first son, and she went on to have six more children. And it was all, you know, they all credited this breakthrough. And similarly, you know, James Harrison in Australia, his daughter and son-in-law, also would have, they had the incompatible blood. They had the Rh situation as well. And so James's own daughter would need the Rh treatment, where the blood came from her own father. And so it's very personal and it's very dramatic. And I'm glad you pointed those unexpected twists and turns up.
Yeah, they really are. And you know, Julianne, to conclude our conversation today, I'm going to do something here that kind of pulls us into the present time. I was here at the break room where I work just a day or two ago, and I saw a sign on the wall, and it was reminding people, if you're in the break room and you're going to eat your food and if you take off your mask, this is, of course, all about COVID-19, remember that you're more vulnerable when that mask comes off, and so keep your distance from people. Well, I was thinking about that sign, and it occurred to me that part of the motivation that is encouraged there is a motivation of self-interest, where people are being told, you'll be safer, don't take the risk, or if you do take the risk, know that you're taking the risk and stand back and be safe. Those are good messages. And yet, in an interesting way, there's also a campaign here, there, and the other place to tell people in the age of COVID, think about the other person. Think not so much about you getting infected, but maybe the fact that you might infect somebody else. And there's an altruistic kind of motivation there. And the stories you have in your book are just filled with this altruism, which is, I think, far more inspiring than just the idea of self-interest in preserving ourselves and having our own babies. To think of those mothers who had lost their babies and yet would come forward to help others. That's the inspiration I see.
Well, I do too. And I also think it's a powerful story about think of others. And if there is self-interest, which, you know, we cannot shy away from always, you know, think of others, but look at how thinking of others affected, you know, their own lives, you know, James, in such a positive way. So it served in a way their ultimate self-interest by doing good for others. You know, when doing good for others was the objective, it came back to them in really wonderful ways. You know, James Harrison has grandsons because he was such a generous blood donor. James, you know, John Gorman has, you know, a whole bundle of nieces and nephews because of this breakthrough. So, you know, doing good in the world is the message. But, you know, it's also one of those things that I think undeniably it will make your individual life better. And that's what this story is about. You know, James's story has always felt resonant to me because he reminds us of what is important in life. He was never after money or fame. You know, he never accepted a penny for his valuable blood. For John, it was coming up with a simple solution to a complex problem. And, you know, they both were a part of a treatment that is all about medical heroes and the magic, you know, the power of medicine. So it's a very pertinent, relevant, timely story today.
Julian Guthrie is author of Good Blood, A Doctor, A Donor, and the Incredible Breakthrough That Saved Millions of Babies. Tomorrow here on the show, the sobering story of one of the world's great inland seas, the Aral Sea. It's a vast inland body of water on the border between Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan. It proved to be too tempting a target for agricultural and engineering experts under the former Soviet Union. They couldn't resist tampering with it. What happens when one of the world's largest lakes runs out of water? Find out tomorrow here on Constant Wonder, and also find out if it's possible to restore that lake today. I'm Marcus Smith. Our show is a production of BYU Radio.